Hello, everyone. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with the nation's top policy experts. I'm Barbara Lyons with the Kaiser Family Foundation. On February 4th, President Obama signed into law legislation that reauthorizes and expands the Children's Health Insurance Program, which will now be known as CHIP. The law is expected to extend coverage through CHIP and Medicaid to an additional 4 million children who would otherwise be uninsured, with an additional $33 billion in federal funds over the next 4.5 years. The passage of this law ends 2 years of uncertainty regarding the future of the CHIP program. Congressional efforts to reauthorize similar bills in 2007 failed twice in the face of vetoes by President Bush, with the new Congress making CHIP reauthorization an early legislative priority and President Obama signing the measure into law within hours of congressional passage, children's coverage enters a new era. Today we're going to talk about the key components of the new law. What impact will it have on coverage of children? What new tools and incentives will be available to reach and enroll uninsured children in Medicaid and CHIP? How will the availability of new federal funds affect state efforts to move forward in the midst of a deepening recession? And finally, how does the passage of CHIP reauthorization affect efforts aimed at broader health reform? We're joined by an esteemed panel of experts to highlight what's in the new legislation and what its passage means for efforts to provide health coverage for children in the U.S. Robin Rudowitz is Principal Policy Analyst with the Kaiser Family Foundation's Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured. Alan Weil is Executive Director of the National Academy for State Health Policy. And Cindy Mann is Executive Director of the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown University's Health Policy Institute. As always, you can submit questions at any time during the show by emailing them to ask@kaisernetwork.org. We'll try to get to as many of you as we can. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And thanks to each of you for being here with us today in the studio. Robin, let's start with you. Can you set the stage for us? How do CHIP and Medicaid work today? What does the legislation that was passed by the Congress and signed by the President last week do? What are the key provisions of the law? How's it paid for?
Sure. Thanks, Barbara. I will, before I jump into the details of the bill, talk about an overview of children's coverage and just provide a few reminders. Medicaid is the country's primary insurance program for low-income children. The CHIP program was established in 1997 to build on Medicaid and provide coverage to low-income uninsured children who earn too much or families earn too much to qualify for Medicaid but couldn't afford private coverage. The two programs together have been extremely successful in reducing the rate of uninsurance for low-income children. Both programs are set up as matching programs, meaning that for every dollar that states spend on the program, the federal government matches those dollars spent. But a key difference between the two programs is that Medicaid is an entitlement with open-ended federal funding, whereas the CHIP program is a capped entitlement and capped funding is set nationally and by state. The CHIP program was set to expire in 2007, and as you mentioned, after a long battle to reauthorize the program, the final bill was passed, which essentially extends and expands the current CHIP program. And the bill is very long and has a lot of provisions, but I want to highlight five key components of the bill. The first, as you mentioned, the bill does provide substantial new funding for children's coverage and also new tools to reach uninsured children. The bill provides an additional $33 billion over the next 4.5 years for both CHIP and Medicaid programs in new financing for those programs, and also fiscal incentives for states to reach children who are eligible for these programs but not enrolled. For example, for states that enroll a higher than targeted levels of Medicaid children, so the focus is on these very low-income children, they could be eligible or qualify for a performance bonus. Of course, to be eligible for that bonus, they also need to adopt 5 out of 8 simplifications to their enrollment process as well. The second key component of the bill that I want to talk about is how the bill changes some provisions related to eligibility. It's important to remember that the bill does preserve states' abilities to set their own income levels for the program, but for states that choose to cover children above 300% of the poverty level, they would be reimbursed at that lower Medicaid match rate for those kids, as opposed to the higher CHIP match. The bill does provide some new coverage options for states. For example, they would now be allowed the option to cover pregnant women and also legal immigrant children and pregnant women in their first 5 years in the country. This was a ban that was imposed as part of welfare reform in 1996. A third key component of the bill is the legislation makes some important changes to benefits. The new bill would require that state CHIP plans include dental benefits or benchmark dental benefits, and states would also have the option to provide wraparound coverage for dental for some children that are insured but don't have dental coverage. The bill also has a focus on access and quality. There's a new commission that will be looking at access and payment policies from both Medicaid and CHIP, and there are some new initiatives around quality and demonstrations as well related to quality and electronic health records. And finally, to get to your last point, the bill is financed by an increase in the federal tobacco tax or increase in the cigarette tax of 62 cents per pack. So those are some of the overview highlights of the bill, and I'm sure we'll discuss many of the other provisions as we continue.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Robin. Great job succinctly boiling the key aspects down for us. So the legislation provides states with additional federal financing, fiscal incentives to reach low-income uninsured children, and tools to streamline enrollment. The most immediate change is probably changing the program name from S-CHIP to back to CHIP, as it was in the original 97 legislation. But Alan, let's turn to you. The states have been in limbo for over a year now, operating their CHIP programs with a temporary extension of federal funds. Does reauthorization provide a modicum of certainty for states who are unquestionably facing great uncertainty right now? What does the reauthorization mean for states?
The reauthorization of CHIP is terrific news for states. My organization, the National Academy for State Health Policy, has been the organizational home for the nation's CHIP directors since the program began. And before the first efforts at reauthorization a couple of years ago, we convened the directors and developed a set of principles regarding reauthorization. We updated those recently for this round of the discussion. I think it's fair to say that the bill, as enacted, very closely adheres to the major principles that the CHIP directors adopted. It's important to see the reauthorization in light of a slightly broader context. We do have the administration announcing the planned withdrawal of what was known as the August 17th directive, which really restricted states' ability to expand the program. And then, of course, there's the fiscal stimulus package, which has tremendous, much larger dollar implications for the state fiscal conditions. The constellation of a 4.5-year reauthorization, which is enough time to really think about and plan for the future. You know, there was a time when there was talk of reauthorization only being a much shorter period, and we went through some temporary fixes. So giving a longer time horizon and doing that in the context of some policy choices, which we'll discuss, I'm sure, more over the coming hour, but reflective of state interests with respect to coverage, with respect to benefits, with respect to the financing of the program, in the context of the directive and the fiscal stimulus, really puts states on a very good path for going forward.
Good. And so our states are obviously cash-strapped right now. Are those, even with a strong commitment to moving forward on improving coverage to children, likely to do that in the current situation?
Well, there's a lot we don't know. What we do know is that the process of turning the ship of state, if you will, is slow, and that the number of things that have happened that have put barriers in the way of states expanding coverage has been substantial. And now we see a quick shift. We definitely hear in a number of states, very rapid response to the new legislation, saying, again, the combination of that and the withdrawal of the CMS directive, saying, you know, now plans that we had in place to do expansions, which we had to put on hold because of some combination of CMS directive and uncertainty regarding the future of the program, we can now gear up again. Of course, it's early in the calendar year, and state legislative sessions are and budget cycles are starting up. So there's a real opportunity for discussions now that when many of those items had been put on hold for some time. So it will take a while for us to see the full implications of this package of changes. But I would say the tone of the discussion, the opportunities for discussion at the state level have really turned in a very positive direction, and that happened very quickly.
Good. Cindy, let me bring you into the conversation. Families are also experiencing some really tough budget times right now as jobs are being lost and incomes are going down and health insurance is being lost. What are the implications of CHIP reauthorization for families? How many people will be helped by this legislation, and who are they?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office has assumed as projected, as you noted, that an additional 4 million children would gain coverage. Most of those children under the CBO's projection would be children who are already eligible for either Medicaid or CHIP. And that would get enrolled and be retained. And I think that's a very important aspect of what the new legislation does, is it provides the funding, the incentives, some new tools to really focus on those lower-income kids who are already eligible but not enrolled. So it both opens the door to some expansions where states are ready to do that, as well as bolsters efforts to secure the program. To just take it to the actual family situation, Greg Sechrest is a man who we interviewed a few months ago. He was actually present on February 4th at the signing ceremony, and he lost his job. He lives in Martinsville, Virginia. He lost his job in a machine shop, and with losing his job, he lost his health insurance, not only for himself but for his two sons. And that actually turned out to be the biggest concern for him, is the loss of health insurance for his sons. He didn't know about CHIP. He didn't know about Medicaid. He was at a meeting of unemployed workers in Martinsville, Virginia, learned about the FAMIS program, enrolled his kids in CHIP. There are a lot more families now, like the Sechrest family, that are losing their health insurance and that need to turn to CHIP and to Medicaid. And the predictable and much more secure and adequate funding for the program gives a greater guarantee, not a certainty, but a greater guarantee that those programs will be there. There's another child in Ohio, Emily Demko. She's maybe four. She's a toddler. She's been waiting for the Ohio expansion about half her life. She has Down syndrome. And Ohio passed an expansion a couple of years ago to move from 200 to 300% of poverty, but was stopped by the August 17th directive that Alan referred to. And now Ohio is going to go through with its expansion, and Emily will be able to get coverage.
Good. In the law's perhaps most contentious provision, states now have the option to provide coverage to legal immigrant children and pregnant women who have been in the country for less than 5 years. What will this change actually mean in state programs? How many people will be affected by this? What do we expect to see?
Well, like other aspects of the law, we always have to be mindful that this law is not self-executing, that it really depends on what states do in response to the new dollars, the new incentives, the new tools. So this provision gives states the option, but it's not a requirement to lift that ban, which was a waiting period. Essentially, kids had to wait 5 years before they could get coverage. It's an option. 17 states now cover those children with their state dollars, feeling that it was that important not to discriminate among kids based on how long they had been in the country. So presumably for those states, they will turn their funding into CHIP funding and meet the benchmark requirements of the CHIP program and receive financial assistance, which will really help them be able to hold on to that coverage for really very low-income kids. And we're hopeful that a number of other states will pick up that option and move forward immediately and over the next period of time.
Good. And what about, we did have an email question about parent coverage. How does the law change how parents are covered under CHIP? What are the new requirements?
I'll let you.
Well, the law specifies that no states cannot receive any new waivers to cover parents under the program, and for states that are currently covering parents through their CHIP program, there is a mechanism to create a separate funding source within the CHIP program to cover them. So it essentially limits and phases parent coverage a little bit out of the CHIP program. Mm-hmm. So the Deficit Reduction Act prohibited any new waivers for adults without dependent children, and those few individuals without childless adults will be phased out of the CHIP program, and states could move that coverage to their Medicaid programs.
Mm-hmm. Just to give a little context on that, I think that there really, at this point, there's only 11 states that remain with these adult waivers. Some of them had pretty robust enrollment, some of them very minimal enrollment. Many of the states that had these CHIP waivers were states that, for a variety of reasons, didn't have really the option to draw down their CHIP dollars for children and were bolstering family coverage for the CHIP dollars. Clearly, there was a very strong sense in Congress across the aisles that the CHIP program should not be used to fund parents and childless adults. And those steps were taken, as Robin described. The unfortunate part, of course, is these are largely very low-income adults, family coverage is terribly important for the family's well-being, for the child's well-being. And so it really points to the need to move forward and think about other ways to make sure that we've bolster states' ability to provide some coverage to those adults. Nobody would argue that they didn't need the coverage that was being provided through those state mm-hmm. programs, just that there was a decision that CHIP was not the right vehicle.
Thank you. Immediately after President Obama signed the legislation, you mentioned that he rescinded the August 17th directive, which had limited states' ability to cover children in families with incomes above 250% of poverty. Robin, can you tell us how that directive had affected coverage of children? And then I want to turn to Cindy and Alan to talk about how repealing the directive will affect state efforts going forward.
Well, Cindy already gave the example mm-hmm. of Ohio, right. But there are a few other states. Well, at the time that the directive was put in place, we had expected that 23 states would have been affected by the directive, a bunch of states that had already expanded coverage beyond those levels, and other states that had authorized in their state legislatures coverage to higher levels that were essentially prohibited from going to those levels. Another good example is Louisiana, where the state had authorized coverage up to 300% of the federal poverty level, and in response to the directive had to scale coverage back to 250% of the poverty level and move forward in that way. Some other states, like New York and Wisconsin, also had approved coverage and moved forward with those coverage expansions using their state-only dollars to fund those expansions. So the lifting of the directive certainly allows more states to move forward in that direction, particularly states that had wanted to do so and were held up by that barrier.
You know, you wouldn't know it from some of the political discussions preceding reauthorization, but there really is a broad understanding at the state level in a bipartisan way that the core purpose of the program is to reach the lowest income children in need to layer on top of Medicaid, which does provide a base of coverage. That is a broadly held view. There's no sense that at the state level that somehow states are looking to try to find ways to subsidize coverage for families that don't need it. What's challenging once you go beyond that general sentiment is how do you make that happen? And there's some things that we've learned, and the challenge is the tension between what we've learned and then what some of these policies are. So one of the things we've learned is that as you raise your income thresholds, you actually bring in a lot more lower-income kids. One of the first things that happened after SCHIP was implemented is that states saw more growth in their Medicaid enrollment than they did in their SCHIP enrollment, because you sent out a broader message of coverage for kids, and you picked up families that might not otherwise have heard. Similarly with the parents. Again, it became a contentious sort of political issue, but the motivation was that we know that parents, when they're covering their entire family, are first of all more likely to enroll, and second of all, they're more likely to utilize services when they have coverage. So all of these are ways to try to reach the population that we all agree is most in need of coverage. So the other thing is that as states move up the income scale, they almost uniformly charge premiums, some of the premiums approaching the full cost of coverage. So it's not like we're talking about giving out free insurance coverage to families making $70,000 a year. That's not states politically, even if they wanted to do that, politically it wouldn't be viable at the state level any more than it is at the federal level. So if you look at the overall texture of the law, in addition to the specific provisions, what you see is, I think, a shifting acknowledgement through performance incentives associated with enrollment and the and some of these other coverage provisions are designed to say states should really make an effort to reach these families and will be rewarded for doing so, and I think that's really consistent with what the program was always intended to be. In the first instance, as with the immigrant provisions, in the first instance, I think what we would expect to see is that states that already had plans to go higher, but then were held back, will now say, well, here's our opportunity. But then probably over time, additional states, and particularly as the fiscal conditions improve, additional states will say, well, that's an option available to us. So all of these provisions, as Cindy noted, it's very important. Very little about this legislation will happen until states make choices about how they're going to respond. I think the combination of improving fiscal conditions and some of these substantive provisions suggests that we will see states taking up these options.
Good. I also wanted, we did get another email question that wanted to know about the premium assistance provisions included in the law, and so I was wondering if one of you could speak to that.
There's, I'll jump in, there's a new premium assistance option in CHIP. States have been struggling, yay, these many years in the CHIP program, to basically put a square peg in a round hole. They've been interested in using CHIP dollars to subsidize private insurance, where private insurance might be available to a family. But CHIP covers the child, and private insurance available through the workplace generally covers the family. And as we just talked about, there's really not room in the CHIP program as it's constituted for covering families. So the equation and the rules that states had to go through in terms of being able to determine whether they could use their CHIP dollars to subsidize private insurance were a little bit of a mismatch, and really states had a lot of difficulty making that work. So there's a new option that does allow states to use premium assistance, use some of their CHIP dollars to purchase private insurance, to subsidize private insurance for families that have access to it. And it makes it clear that states can do that if they make a determination that it's cost-effective to do so, looking at the benefits, looking at the administrative costs, and that if the package that they're subsidizing leaves out key benefits that would otherwise be covered in their CHIP program or cost-sharing protections that they wrap around that benefit. There's what we've seen in the actual experience of states is there's not a lot of there's a lot of interest in premium assistance, but there's just not a lot of premium assistance coverage that's gained, in large part because the families that are applying to CHIP and to Medicaid are families that don't have viable employer-based coverage options where you have a substantial employer contribution. So I think it remains to be seen whether we see significant enrollment in these premium assistance programs. There were some additional changes in the law, though, that I think are very helpful for states and for families, which changed some of the rules in ERISA, allowing for open enrollment and a little bit easier time as families move back and forth between private insurance coverage to the workplace and the public programs, so that the rules allow a family whose situation changes to be able to enroll in employer-based coverage despite open and closed enrollment periods. And there's a new provision that allows states to get information from employers about their insurance plan, which puts them in a better position to be able to assess that cost-effectiveness standard.
Okay. I want to focus in a little bit on reaching low-income children who have been eligible for Medicaid or CHIP and not enrolled. The legislation does, you've all noted, provide new tools to reach kids. Robin, I was wondering if you could start by reviewing for us where states are now in terms of enrollment procedures and what are these new tools that are out there that states should be able to take advantage of going forward.
Sure. Well, since CHIP was enacted, many states have moved forward aggressively in both their CHIP programs and Medicaid in trying to ease the enrollment and application process to eliminate barriers to enrollment. So at this point, almost all states in the country have removed the face-to-face interview, so applicants don't need to come into the office when they're applying for the program or at the time that they're renewing their coverage. Most states have also dropped the assets test for assets are not included in the eligibility calculations for children in most states across the country. Fewer states have adopted other very successful strategies in helping children get enrolled and stay enrolled in the program. One of those is providing guaranteed coverage for 12 months or 12-month continuous eligibility, as well as doing administrative verification at the time of renewal to keep, again, help keep children who are enrolled enrolled in the program at their time of renewal. Those are some of the options that are available to states or that states would need to take up in order to be eligible for those performance bonuses that we talked about before. And there's an additional option for states to use Express Lane eligibility. So if children are eligible for other programs, they can be enrolled in the Medicaid and CHIP program if they choose that option as well. So I think some of those are, in addition, there's also some dedicated funding for outreach activities in the bill, which given the economic situation, sometimes states, that's one of the first things that states need to cut, and this the new bill provides dedicated funding source for outreach, so states can do that on a continual basis.
I want to go back to the bonus payments. There's a lot of interest in what those payments are and how they would work. Could someone explain how that part of the legislation would be implemented?
Sure, I can jump in. The performance bonus is really geared towards the phenomenon that Alan described, which is when you do a better job simplifying your program or doing outreach, when you put that welcome mat out. In fact, a lot of the children that you get, appropriately so, are the lowest income Medicaid eligible children. Those are the largest segment of uninsured children right now in the country, so it is appropriate that that's where we focus attention. States, however, that see their Medicaid enrollment rise get a lower match rate, as Robin pointed out before, than they get when they see their CHIP program enrollment rise. And so the performance bonus is, in the way I think about it, really recognizes that states that are performing well in terms of boosting their participation rates among Medicaid-eligible children are sustaining a higher share of those costs relative to the CHIP kids. And so it begins to deal with that inequity and really the significant burden that it can cause for states. So the way it works is that state has sort of the entrance fee to getting your performance bonus is that you have to have adopted and have implemented 5 out of 8 of these what are sometimes called simplification measures, although one of them is premium assistance, which I don't think falls into a simplification measure. 5 out of 8 of these measures have them in effect, and you also have to meet a pretty stringent enrollment exceed an enrollment target for your children. So you actually not just say you're simplifying your program, but you actually have to show it because you've got enrollment gains. And a state can qualify each year based on the combination of did they adopt the 5 out of 8 for that entire year and did they meet or exceed the enrollment target. If they do that, then they get a payment that's geared to what their per capita costs are for their children in the Medicaid program and how many children they actually did enroll in excess of those targets.
Thank you. One area where states have struggled with over the past couple years has been the implementation of the DRA citizenship documentation requirement in Medicaid. the new law applies those requirements to children in CHIP as well, but gives states the ability to use data matching through SSA to comply with those requirements. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the impact of that provision will be? Will it really reduce the burdens that states have faced with those requirements and that families have faced in meeting those requirements in Medicaid? Are we likely to see less of a lag in enrollment due to meeting those requirements going forward?
Well, in the first instance, the application of the requirements to the separate SCHIP programs is something that the states aren't that enthusiastic mm-hmm. about. So as with many provisions of the law, the how it works actually on the ground is going to determine a lot of how it plays out. The concept of being able to do a data match is great, and it could do exactly as you suggested, speed things up. The practicality of how that works is going to be a big determinant of whether or not that's actually the result we end up with. And so I think it's a good statement of a direction to go in, but I think until those systems are really up and running, it's going to be hard to say if that offsets the burden that's been created.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's right. I think the proof will be in the pudding and how easy it is for states to interface with the SSA. There is some additional funding in the bill that would help states upgrade their systems to make that happen. A significant change and improvement also is that families that are applying for Medicaid or CHIP can be receiving coverage while they are sorting out documentation issues. That's a big change from what the current law is, what was enacted in DRA. So that should blunt some of the problems that families have found from this provision where they, you know, were not covered at all while they were going through the paper chase of documents. But we'll have to see how it transpires. I mean, all in all, the whole documentation requirement goes exactly in the opposite direction that states were moving in, which is to rely more on databases, to rely on, you know, statements from families to do post-eligibility audits. And so this is an improvement in many ways, other than the fact that now it applies to CHIP as well as to Medicaid. And we'll have to see and evaluate how well it works.
Well, this brings me to the next question, which was really about IT. There's a lot of enthusiasm out there right now for health information technology. How does the reauthorization legislation incorporate HIT into these programs to try to facilitate enrollment for children? Are there specific things that you could speak to?
I'm not sure I'm going to pick up on all the components because mm-hmm. the term health information technology is very broad. First of all, it's worth noting that the stimulus package has a very substantial mm-hmm. right. Amount of funding for the broader issues of health information technology. Robin already referred to express lane eligibility, which is sort of a technology-based notion, or at least it can be, of using eligibility information collected for a different program to facilitate enrollment in SCHIP. And so that's it's not sort of what we think of as core health mm-hmm. information technology, but it's certainly the potential increased use of technology for the program. There are also a series of quality improvement initiatives included in the bill having to do with setting up standards and the Secretary leading a process around standards for children's coverage, which trying to monitor states' performance relative to those standards will depend on having some of the information systems in place. So I don't know if I've left out anything big, but those are all sort of information technology components that are parts of the bill.
Great. Thanks, Alan. We know from the work that we've done with families that families really want to have multiple ways to get into the program, but that having folks at the community-based level to actually help people learn about these programs and get enrolled in these programs are critical. And I was wondering if you could comment a little bit about what, with the reauthorization, community-based groups can do now to go ahead and try and get out there and reach and enroll kids.
Well, for one, they have less concern, hopefully no concern at all, about the states, the program running into federal shortfalls, which, of course, is what we were facing with if the program hadn't been reauthorized, and some of the states that we also referenced before that were on hold in terms of what they were doing with their programs now know what the rules are and can make those clean, clear decisions. That makes it a lot easier for community-based workers to be able to help and enroll eligible families. The outreach provisions in the law will provide, it's about $100 million, it's exactly $100 million over the period of the reauthorization that's available that the Secretary has the discretion to dispense. Some is for set aside for a national outreach campaign, but most of it will go to the community. It can go to states, it can go to local governments, it can go to local nonprofit organizations, it can go to Indian tribes. There's quite a bit of discretion in it, and I think that's one area where we may actually see a significant boost in those community-based arrangements for people to be able to really get in the neighborhoods and on the ground and be able to reach out to families. And I think we've learned a lot about what works in those community-based settings, and we also have to grow our sense of what's needed in light of families like the Seacrests. Mm-hmm. That have not necessarily had experience with CHIP and Medicaid before, but are now unemployed, uninsured, and we need to think of some other and additional ways to be able to reach out to families.
Do we have any sense of the time frame for when these funds would be available?
We were just making a list of key dates, and there really isn't a key date on that on the outreach dollar. So I'm certain when we get a secretary, that'll be a high priority, since certainly the whole issue of enrolling children is a high priority for the Obama administration. But there isn't a date certain for it.
Good. We had talked about the certainty of the financing being an important point going forward here. One of the key challenges to CHIP over the past years has been this mismatch between federal funds and the state needs to run their programs. How does the legislation change the way the federal funds actually flow to states to finance coverage of children?
That's so complex. I think only Robin is capable of explaining
that. You can jump in and correct me. But it essentially changes the way that the allotments work for the states. In the past, they've been based on the number of low-income children in a state as well as number of low-income uninsured children. And they were established when the program was established in 1997, and now they, as you mentioned, there's a great mismatch between what states need, and most states at this point are spending more than what their annual allotment is. So the bill essentially provides a few different options to look at. The new allotments will essentially be based on what states are actually spending or what their spending projections are, and then 110% of the highest of those options. So it'll set a higher allotment for all states moving forward, and then there are also mechanisms to rebase those allotments. So there's a constant updating of making sure that the allotments are really keeping track with how states needs and how states are spending that money. And again, there is more money in the system, so hopefully that will address some of the issues related to states that were experiencing shortfalls in their allotments. At this point, most states were really financing their program with prior year allotments, so this really does make a big jump in correcting some of those some of that problem.
That was terrific. In the very early years of the program, the allotments were much greater than what states were spending because the program was just starting up. So states could basically grow their programs at whatever rate their own ability to design and implement and what eligibility levels they set. We then entered into this phase where a few large states and many others as well, but a few large states, whether they were or were not spending their full allotments, had huge implications for this redistribution formula that was complicated, had to be revised a few times. And then, as Robin said, towards the end, it became very difficult for states to plan because you didn't know how much you would have. Congress came in and fixed. They did partial fixes. There were how do you the way the dollars were reallocated was changed. The new formula is much gives states much better ability to plan. Not only is there a larger sum of money, which is of course always makes allotments easier, but also the ability to look forward and say, if we do this, this is how much we anticipate being able to have. And in fact, under the new law, it shortens the amount of time states have to spend their allotment so that there's a cleaner process. You aren't waiting for years-old information to come forward and figure out how much is going to be available. So there's no way in a capped, allocated program to give states complete certainty to plan for the future. But by both changing away from the sort of formula that may have worked a decade ago but certainly didn't make any sense now, but also coming up with a set of choices for how you set the state allotment, it really is a much more a viable platform for states to make decisions. And I would just say that as we are in this economic downturn and states are maybe a little shy about going forward, knowing that the statute and the funding is in place for a number of years into the future means that assuming we hit the bottom and start seeing some clear blue sky in front of us, again, it'll be much easier for states to say, if we make this commitment, we can feel confident that the federal dollars will be there as well. Mm-hmm.
The other issue I think that's important to note is that in changing the way the formula works, it puts the money where the states are spending it, as Robin noted, so you get rid of that mismatch. And in so doing, you also send the message to states that you get the dollars if you are spending the dollars, not because you deserve the dollars pursuant to some formula that's written in the statute. And so it is, to some degree, an incentive for states to say, you know, you won't build up your allotment unless, in fact, you have been covering kids and doing so in a robust way, and that's the way you earn your way to the next level of allotment in the rebasing years. So it's a positive dynamic, both in terms of making sure the dollars are there when for the states that are spending it, and also to provide an incentive for states to be looking to cover the eligible children in their states.
Thank you. I want to shift gears a little bit. We've gotten a lot of questions about the benefits and access and quality provisions in the reauthorization. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the changes to dental and mental health care for kids.
So there's both a requirement to include a dental benefit and an ability to wrap around. Historically, if a child had any coverage, SCHIP was not available at all, and what states learned is that there were a lot of kids coming in with inadequate coverage, and basically what you were saying to the family is if you want to get decent coverage, you have to drop your coverage, which they didn't want to do, and the states didn't want them to do. So you have both the addition of the benefit and the wraparound option under certain circumstances, and then you have some mental health parity language, which says that you can't have different cost sharing and caps on mental health services. I think it's important in the time we have here to note that so many, forgive me for being a bit of a broken record here, but so many of the ways in which the law will play out will depend on what choices states make. And so much of the influence of those choices will be the regulations and the definition of provisions that are still that were somewhat uncertain in the statute. When SCHIP was first enacted, there was a very positive feedback loop between states and the federal government. We were all trying to figure out how to cover these kids, and so the regulations to implement the program were developed in a way that reflected the experience and the needs of the states with a joint goal of trying to reach and enroll kids. I think it's fair to say from what I've heard from the CHIP directors that sentiment was not very much felt in some recent years. And so I think for many of these provisions, and here I bring it up in this instance, but it applies to premium assistance, it applies to bonuses, it applies to the quality standards and the like, what we really need need is a dialogue between the federal government and the states who are trying to make these things happen. And in many instances, it's the states raising these issues that said, we want to provide dental. Let's help make it possible. We want to have premium assistance programs. Let's make it possible. If we can continue to have that positive interchange and view this as a joint effort to provide the best possible coverage to children who need it, then I think we're going to be well situated to have a positive experience with these options. And by contrast, and this, of course, isn't going to happen, but by contrast, if the rules and regulations with respect to these provisions are really generated in a way that doesn't adhere to what states need to do to make these provisions work, they'll be there in statute. Everyone will say, you know, there's these provisions, but in fact they won't have the intended effect.
I want to turn to the stimulus package. Congress has reached a deal on the stimulus package and is expected to send it to the president soon. The package does contain fiscal relief for the states through a temporary boost to the Medicaid matching rates for states that maintain eligibility and enrollment procedures. Robin, what do we know about the fiscal relief experience in the last recession? And then I want to turn to Alan and Cindy for what we expect the implications of the stimulus for children's coverage to be this time around.
Well, during the last economic downturn, which was pretty much from 2001 to 2004, during that period in 2003, Congress did step in and provide additional fiscal relief in the form of this enhanced matching rate for state Medicaid programs on the condition that they maintain their Medicaid eligibility levels. And we did some research that looked at the experience that states had with that, and it showed that most states it was a successful strategy in getting money out quickly to states and also really help states meet their Medicaid budget shortfalls and help avoid deeper cuts to their Medicaid programs. All states adopted an array of measures to control costs in their Medicaid programs, but this helped avoid some of those deeper cuts. So similar to the last time, the federal government would be assuming a larger share of Medicaid costs on a temporary basis, provided that states do meet these maintenance of effort requirements. And those maintenance of effort requirements are more stringent than the last time because they do apply to processes and procedures around enrollment as well as just eligibility levels. During the last downturn, those provisions didn't apply to procedural issues, and many states did make changes that created some barriers, which had very significant effects on caseloads by retracting 12-month continuous eligibility or requiring more documentation to control their caseloads. Some states did put those things in place, and they really did have a dramatic effect, and we found that when the downturn ended, they tried to reinstate some of the simplifications to help ease enrollment again. So this time, those type of changes would be protected.
But to be clear, they're protected in Medicaid, not exactly. In CHIP, not in the CHIP program. I want to, as we come down to the end here, shift gears yet again to talk about broader health reform issues. When the president signed the reauthorization legislation, he said the bill was a first step toward universal coverage. And while the bill does provide a lot of opportunities to cover more children, it won't reach all uninsured children. But does it put us on a glide path to reaching all children and all Americans down the road?
No, it doesn't put us on a glide path. It's a good step. Uh-huh. And I think, again, in conjunction with your question regarding the stimulus, we know that states want to cover children. Mm-hmm. We know that in economic downturns, Medicaid has a protected status, partly because of the vulnerability of the population it serves, partly because of the match rate. And we know that SCHIP has an even slightly more protected status because it's children and because of a higher match rate. But we also know that the longer the downturn persists, states lose their ability to find other ways to make the dollars work. And none of us know how long this downturn is going to be. SCHIP is not an entitlement. It is not universal coverage for children. Mm-hmm. It does not provide countercyclical support in an economic downturn, despite the fact that states have to balance their budgets. That's over in the stimulus, and we'll have to see if we need another one and if it's adequate and the formula for how that plays out across states, whether it matches where states are. SCHIP makes a nice a move forward on quality. But it's a pretty small step. It's an important one. But glide path suggests that you've already done all the thrust and from here you're coasting. And there's definitely no coasting ahead. So I think it's a very positive statement about the nation's commitment. It's certainly far better than either just a one-year renewal or not letting the program cover those, not having sufficient funding to cover those for whom it was intended. There are many things to feel very enthusiastic about. But there's no question that universal coverage for children with high-quality care, there's no question that a cost containment agenda that we need throughout the healthcare system to protect against the erosion of private coverage for those who have it, and of course the changes are phasing out coverage for adults without children and freezing coverage for parents. All of those leave huge gaps. Even the recent immigrants is just an option. Terrific positive statement, but there is plenty more work to be done.
And I think echo exactly what Alan said and go back to what we were saying earlier, which is virtually all of the positive features of CHIP in terms of what the expectation is in terms of additional children gaining coverage will depend on state efforts moving forward. And this is a particularly difficult time for states. When we talk about universal coverage, we have an expectation that it doesn't depend, that it's there, that it's a guarantee, that the mechanisms are simple for families to enroll and to retain coverage, that the financing is secure, open-ended, not capped, that we have countercyclical financing as a matter of course as opposed to when Congress thinks about doing it. So I think looking at what happens in CHIP will be not only important step forward but really lessons as we go forward and look at health reform.
Well, I was going to also ask whether there are lessons to be gleaned from the CHIP reauthorization experience that would be useful for health reform going forward.
Yes. I suppose we could start with the simplest, which is that who the President of the United States is matters when it comes to health policy, because clearly the final bill has a lot in common. It's not identical, but it has a lot in common with an earlier bill. But our prior president chose to veto it, and now we have a president who would sign it. I think CHIP really does have bipartisan origins, and it has very strong bipartisan support at the state level as well as among many at the national level. So I think there is an ability to have a bipartisan effort and a bipartisan discussion. But I think it also points up the risks, the ability for people to take one small component of the program and turn it into sort of a referendum on that. Even the fact that you, in asking the question, said one of the most contentious issues had to do with recent immigrants. Well, as a portion of what this program is about and what it does, that is a small corner. It's an important one, but it's a small one. So I think one of the lessons out of the debate is that if you're trying to block health reform, and we know this from earlier experience, but we saw it play out in CHIP, it's very easy to take specific provisions and sort of turn them into things that maybe they actually aren't, but it sounds like you couldn't possibly want to do that, and turn the debate into a referendum on a very small issue. So I think it suggests that bipartisanship is possible, but that it's fragile. And we're certainly going to have to keep that in mind as we have a broader discussion about health reform.
Ron?
I mean, I would just underscore the notwithstanding the fact, and I think somebody used the word battle before, some of the what has felt like battles over the last couple of years on CHIP, that there was really an extraordinary agreement. There was extraordinary agreement among members of Congress in both parties. There was not extraordinary agreement, obviously, with the White House. There was extraordinary agreement among states. Among the advocates, the principles that Alan referred to are principles that I think are very strongly agreed to by a vast array of players. So the good news is that when you can get down to the details and when you can get down to the real substance, there's quite a bit of agreement and quite a bit of commitment, certainly on covering children. But I think beyond that, but it can be very fragile in the sense that you can pervert the discussion quite a bit. But in the end, we had pretty strong bipartisan vote in both the House, less so in the Senate, but still a bipartisan vote in the Senate. And I think the real test of bipartisanship in terms of this program is to look at what goes on in the states. It is not just a few states here and there that have shown in terms of what they've done in terms of covering kids. It's really a very diverse array of states around the country with Republican governors, Democratic governors, and different members of majorities in their legislatures. So if we can try and get past roadblocks and really keep our eye on the ball, there's really quite a bit of agreement about going forward.
Good. Okay, well, we're down to the end, so I think that's probably a good place to leave it. I want to thank you each for being here today, and I'd like to extend thanks to all of you for joining us. I'm Barbara Lyons, and you've been watching Ask the Experts at KaiserNetwork.org.